This presentation is sponsored by Lumina Foundation as part of WFYI's American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Lumina Foundation's goal is to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Goal 2025 is focused especially on adults, first-generation college students, low-income students, and students of color.
Well, hello, everyone. Thanks for coming out. We'll just tell people watching online that it was a full house. Well, thanks for having me out here. I love talking about education and Manual High School in particular. It was a big part of my life. Kind of changed the way I look about my job of being a columnist at the paper. As a special treat tonight, Spencer Lloyd, who's a pretty big figure in the book, teacher at Manual, is in the house. And I thought when we get to the question and answer section that maybe he can come up here and take some of your questions, because he's the real expert on education. I'm just the journalist who got to be a fly on the wall at the school for a year. People often ask me why I went to Manual High School and spent a year there. And the theme of tonight's program is, what did I learn during the year, lessons learned during the year there. And you know, I went to Manual High School for the same reason that a lot of people go to school, to learn. it was pretty much that simple. I think education is the overriding issue facing our city and the future of our city. I think the question of whether more students, more kids in this generation and the next generation can get quality educations, high school degrees, maybe something beyond that, hopefully, is really the question that's going to shape the future of this city and cities just like it and towns like it all over the country. Now, if you step back a little bit beyond that or look deeper into the question of what I learned or why I went there in the first place, there really were three reasons. One is that I was just bothered by this issue of the low graduation rate in Marion County. And you just knew it was crushing the hopes and dreams of a generation of kids that as a city, we just couldn't sustain losing thousands of kids to dropping out every year, every generation. And it was a emerging issue or an increasingly big issue in the city in public policy debates, and I was writing about them a lot. And I just wanted to know a little bit more about what was really going on the ground. Instead of just covering it from the state house or the school board meetings or you know, the policy papers by interviewing the experts, I wanted to see what was really going on the ground level in a school that was rated as failing by the state, that at the time I first went there had a graduation rate of 39%, and was losing, you know, hundreds of kids every cycle. So I wanted to go and just find out what was really going on. Why are these kids dropping out in such high numbers? At the same time, there was a second reason, and that was that, you know, I would often write about education reform issues, education policy debates. I loved writing about those issues, whether it was issue of charter schools or vouchers or teacher contracts or seniority issues, all those big public policy debates that we're having. I enjoyed writing about them, and I often would take the position on the side of the reformers or I'd take a pretty strong position one way or the other. And I'd hear from teachers constantly. I love talking to teachers. They're so passionate about their jobs and their profession, and they're such interesting people, and they would email me and let me know when they thought I was wrong, and in very strong terms. You know, basically they would mark the paper and, you know, send it back with an F. And I'd get into debates with them about why I thought the way I did, why I thought this law needed to be changed, or why this union policy or contract requirement was wrong. And we'd get into debates going back and forth about these issues, and often the debate ended like this. And it would be, you know, after the fifth or sixth email exchange, the teacher would write something along these lines: what do you know? How much time do you spend in schools? And that was pretty much the end of the debate. What could I say? They were right. They spent every day in schools, 5 days a week, 10 hours a day, you know, year after year. And I would pop into schools here and there, spend a couple days, you know, maybe at one school, or a couple hours at another school. But really, since I graduated high school in 1987, I hadn't spent much time in schools in the big picture. And One, I hated losing the debates. I wished I had a better answer to that. But two, they were right. You know, they were in the school every day. They had a much better understanding of what was going on. And I truly believe that if we're going to have these huge public policy debates about something as important as education, that we all have to be a lot better informed than we are, that we all need to really understand what's going on in the schools, what the challenges are, what the failures are, what the things that the schools are doing right are, and what they're doing wrong. And not just journalists, but public, you know, lawmakers, city council members, the general public, we all need to have a better understanding. And so I went there hoping, for my own sake, to get a better understanding of what was going on, but also hopefully to share with readers of my newspaper of what was going on, maybe in a little more depth than they'd seen. At the third time, and this is a kind of a running theme through the book, I won't talk too much about it unless you want to at the end. You know, I went to Manual High School for the first time in 2009, in August of 2009. And if you go back and look at the coverage of the newspaper industry in 2009, it was pretty bad. Layoffs daily, newspapers were closing down literally, or you know, there was talk that some of them would. There was, you know, lots of doubts about the future of the industry, which there still are, but I think things have improved quite a bit in the last couple of years. But it really was a shaky time. And at that point, I'd been a journalist for 17 years. And I loved it. It was all I ever wanted to do from the time I was a kid. But I'd seen colleagues laid off and helped them carry out their boxes from their desks when they lost their job, and others who left the profession voluntarily because they didn't think there was much of a future. So, you know, I was kind of having that conversation with myself, approaching 40 at the time, thinking, boy, what's going to happen in the next 20 years? What's the profession going to look like? And while I'm very optimistic about the way things are changing now, at the time I was a little nervous, and I thought, well, if this is going to be the end of the road in my journalism career, I want to kind of end with a bang. I want to do something big, not just cover the daily grind beat. And so maybe some big project would be a good thing. So those were the three things that kind of inspired me to go to Manual High School in the first place and end up what turned out to be a year, the entire year there. I will admit I didn't know when I first walked in the door that I was going to be there for the whole year. I didn't know that the school would tolerate me for a year, first of all, because I was going to be writing columns every week while I was there. And some of them were going to be pretty and some weren't going to be pretty, and I didn't know how the school would respond and whether they'd keep welcoming me back week after week. So those are the reasons that I went there in the first place, and that was what I wanted to learn. That was why I went there, and you know, with that goal of learning more. And you know, the most important question to be asked is, well, what did you learn? What did you gain during the year? And I can't tell you how much I gained professionally, as a person. Some of my favorite moments of my life literally happened within that school. Maybe I didn't know it before, but there are very few places that are more interesting than a school, that as a writer offers more drama, positive and negative and everything in between. Schools are just filled with the most interesting characters. First of all, high school is filled with teenagers, and they're just interesting to start off with. Teachers, you're not going to find a more interesting group of people than teachers. As I always say lovingly to teachers, is you got to be a little quirky to be a teacher, because most people don't choose to spend 5 days a week, 9-10 hours a day with kids that aren't their own, trying to educate some kids that may or may not be interested in learning. So schools are just an interesting place. But I've come up with, you know, five main lessons learned throughout the school year, and I'll tell some stories about what I learned as I go through these. Just to give you a little color, you know, the day, I remember the date, it was August 12th, 2009. That was the first day I walked through the doors of Manual High School. I knew no one. That really was one of the few parameters that I set when I decided what school to pick, is that I wanted to go to a school that I had no knowledge of, that I had no relationships at, no friends, no sources. You know, I didn't know one teacher, one student, one administrator at the school. I'd never walked into the school before. I went in there with a completely clean slate. All I knew was, you know, its data, its test scores and its graduation rate, things like that. So I walk in that first day, and it was quiet, and I bumped into this teacher. Her name is Mrs. Howitt, Jill Howitt, and she quickly became one of my favorite people in the school. And if you read the book, if you want to see the legacy of a teacher, you see the story of a couple girls that I met named Kelly and Allison, who I'll talk about in a minute, who are now in college and doing great. And a huge part of the reason that they are doing so well is because Mrs. H, as everyone called her at the school, worked with them from the day she met them as sophomores to the day they graduated, convincing them day after day that they were college material, that they were capable of great things, that they were going to go far, that they just had to stay committed and make sure they were doing the work they needed to do. They came from families where there wasn't a lot of academic background, and so these two young women are doing great today and studying at Vincennes University, and they're going to transfer, I believe, to IU pretty soon. And a lot of that is due to this one teacher. So anyway, I bumped into Mrs. Howitt, and she walks me to the back of the school in the gymnasium, where students were registering for class and getting their book rental papers and all the things that you do early in the school year. And two important things happened that first day at Manual High School. One was that after milling about for a while and talking to people, I met this young woman named Mary. Now, Mary was 17 years old. She'd gone to school the previous year at Manual, but had stopped coming at some point. And her mom, over the summer, convinced her that she should give school one more try. So she showed up on that first day and immediately was told by one of the administrators that she had to tuck in her shirt. Now, Mary didn't like to tuck in her shirt. She thought she looked bad when her shirt was tucked in. And so that morning, by well before 9 o'clock in that first day of school, she decided she was going to drop out. And that was the last, I had a conversation with her that morning, and then that was the last I ever saw her. And it kind of was an early lesson for me about the challenges facing schools and the lack of value that unfortunately still exists in a lot of corners of our city toward education. I always joke with people that if anything shocked me during the year was I thought everyone understood the value of an education. I knew that some people didn't, actually carry it out and get their high school diploma and go on to college or whatever, but that they knew they should get that diploma. I compare it to brushing your teeth, that I know some people don't brush their teeth, but I assume everyone knows they should. That's kind of how I felt with education. But what I found throughout the year was there were kids, unfortunately, who literally did not have a value, understand the value of education. It just hadn't occurred to them. It hadn't been impressed upon them. And so it makes it really hard to see those kids succeed in school. And so you have cases like Mary where she, because she didn't want to tuck in her shirt, she didn't go to school anymore. So that was one thing that happened that day that kind of set the tone for me. The other thing that was important, and I'll get back to this more later, was that I met Spencer Lloyd, who's sitting here in the building. Now, I saw a lot that first those first couple days that really depressed me at the school, that really showed me the challenges facing Manual High School, whether it was some teachers who just weren't putting in the effort, unfortunately, whether it was students that weren't showing up for school, whether it was kids getting arrested or expelled early in the year. But walking into Spencer's class was important for me because, it was just filled with energy and complete engagement of his students. And you walk into that classroom, and I sometimes have compared it to Dorothy walking out of the house at the beginning of Wizard of Oz, and she walks out of the black and white house into that land of color. That's kind of what it was like walking into Spencer's classroom, because I just sat in another classroom where, unfortunately, the teacher had given up, and I'd seen some other things that day that quite concerned me. And then I walked into Spencer's classroom, and it was just a ball of energy. I refer to him all the time as a slightly, but only slightly less manic version of Robin Williams. When I talk to younger kids, I make it Jack White or Jack Black. So they understand. But just, someone who's giving his all every minute of every classroom, of every class period, and understanding that, that kid walks in that door and you got to grab him right away. You got to keep him engaged throughout the entire classroom. You got to let them know that they care about you, that you're willing to, do anything it takes to make sure they learn and get the education they deserve. So those were the two things that I remember from that first day. Lesson learned. Kids in even the hardest hit schools Even the schools with the worst test scores, the highest graduation rates, those schools are filled with kids with just unbelievable potential. Some of the kids that I met that I just considered the smartest, most clever, most interesting kids were also kids that dropped out, who didn't stick with school. Throughout the year, I kept writing this one phrase in my notebook time after time, and it was unfulfilled potential. It was these kids that I would meet that you could just tell they're capable of so much. They could go so far in life. They're so interesting. They're so smart. But for whatever reason, we were losing them as a community. They were disappearing from school. They were there one day and gone the next. And you know, that's obviously a huge loss to our city and to our country, to our state. But it's heartbreaking to think of these kids that aren't getting the opportunities that they need and deserve because they're not sticking with school. I remember one day I was in the school, and I just happened to be... The great thing about embedding yourself in a place like a school for an entire year is that you just come across unbelievable stories or columns. And most of if I was going to rank the columns that I think were the best or the most compelling, so many of them came not because I developed great sources or you know, was working really hard to find some great story. It literally was because I was standing around and something happened right in front of me. And one day I was in the main office killing some time between classes, and these two young men walked in. Their names are Tyler and Chris, and they were trying to withdraw from school, drop out basically, maybe 2 months into the school year. They hadn't been there much. And a vice principal, a guy by the name of Alan Smith, happened to be walking by, recognized the kids from the previous year, stopped, engaged them, you know, got them to start talking and learned the story that they wanted to drop out. He told them, well, you can't. You're 16 and 17. You're not allowed to drop out. It's against the law, basically. And it turned out to be one of my favorite scenes of the entire year, even though there wasn't a happy ending, unfortunately. But it was just this vice principal who had 500 other things on his plate that day, but saw these kids and you know, did everything he could to pull them back into school. They set up a meeting for the next week, convinced them to give school one more try through this program that helps you catch up. And they had to come 15 days in a row. That was the agreement, that for this program to get caught up, to get back into the regular class system, you have to go 15 days in a row. Now, when the principal told these two young men that they had to go to school 15 days in a row, I'll never forget the look on their faces. And when I talked to them later, they said at least since sixth grade, it had been since, that's how long it had been since they'd been to school 15 days in a row, at least since then. You might as well have told them they had to climb, you know, the highest mountain in the country. They knew it was going to be a huge challenge. The good news is they actually ended up making it. The school really worked with them. It's this wonderful program. It was called Vestibule. It leads to another program called the Opportunity Center. But it really is based on understanding that a lot of kids fall, make a mistake when they're 14, 15 years old, drop out of school for a while, get way behind, and you have to find ways to, you know, to meet their needs and to give them another chance. They gave it a chance for a while. They worked hard for a little while. Unfortunately, they ended up dropping out, and it's a heartbreaking story. And to me, it's one of the failures of some of our schools is, you know, that there wasn't another outreach to these kids, that you know, it wasn't treated as, to me, the emergency that it is, that we just can't allow kids to stop coming to school. And only reach out to them if they happen to walk into the school one day to drop out. We have to find ways to engage them, to force them to come back, to do everything it takes to get them more involved in their education. Otherwise, we're just leaving this potential on the streets. I haven't talked to those two young men in 2 years, so I don't know what happened to them. But with no education, it's hard to imagine that they're going to have too many opportunities in their life, and that's just heartbreaking. A lot of the things I learned I already knew, but maybe they were reinforced. One was that I always refer to it as boulders, that a lot of these kids in schools like Manuel have these huge boulders standing in their way, and some of the boulders are as big as this auditorium, some not so big, but so many of these kids have something standing in their way that just makes it hard for them to succeed. And they need people, whether it's, you know, the school, or volunteers or their parents or you know, nonprofits. They need someone to move that boulder out of their way so that they can fulfill the potential that they're capable of. To me, the best example of that is a kid named Brent Jones. I met Brent toward the end of the school year, the second half of the school year, I should say. And I'd heard about him from the dean at the school, or Dean Terry Hoover, who was also one of my favorite human beings on the planet, just a tough-talking, one of those typical kind of heart of gold but kind of gruff exterior. If I was going to make a TV show about a school, Dean Hoover would be one of the characters just because she's such an interesting people. A couple of Manual graduates, I think, remember her. Anyway, Dean Hoover had told me about this young man who literally couldn't prove his identity. Early in his life, his birth mother had given him to a friend to raise and then disappeared. And unfortunately, while Brent was raised in a healthy, loving environment, his birth mother, her disappearance had left him with questions about his identity. He didn't have a birth certificate. He didn't have a Social Security card. He wasn't exactly sure that his name really was his name or that his birth date really was his birth date. And this hadn't been much of a, believe it or not, it hadn't been much of a problem for most of his life. It started to become a problem when he was about 16 and he wanted to get a job and a driver's license and he couldn't do that. And it really became a problem when he reached the end of high school because he wanted to go to college, but he couldn't apply for financial aid without this information, couldn't get a job without this information. It was kind of, as he told me one day, I have this black hole standing, facing me after graduation. So Dean Hoover told me about Brent, and I was obviously intrigued by the story and interested in writing about it, hoping that maybe if we wrote about it, a policymaker would step forward, a member of one of our local delegation, members of the congressional delegation, something like that. And, she told me about it, and I said, yeah, please let him know that I'm interested. And I kind of forgot about it for a couple weeks. And one day I was walking in the school, and this young man kind of shouted my way, and I look over, and I didn't recognize him. And he said his name, and I still didn't click. And he said, I'm the kid who doesn't exist. And meaning, per the government, I don't exist. So I got to know Brent over the next few weeks and heard his story, and it was a really complicated story. He thought he was born in Orlando, Florida, and he'd moved to Indiana when he was about 4 or 5 years old. And, everything I told you before, that he just couldn't prove his identity. He didn't know exactly who it was standing in the way of him, doing all these things he wanted to do. And I met the woman who raised him and other people in his life, and it was a really compelling story. But as a journalist, I was kind of nervous because I couldn't prove any of it. Brent was relying on things he'd been told, and he thought they were true, but he wasn't sure they were true. I was pretty nervous about putting things in the paper that I couldn't prove. So I worked on this, over and over, and I started doing all kinds of internet searches, which were, just didn't turn up anything with the name I had of his birth mother. And but I kept talking to him, and just decided eventually, I'm just going to write this column based on what we know, and hopefully someone will step forward. So interesting thing happened the Sunday before I was going to write the story. My wife and I were at home, and we're watching The Blind Side movie on pay-per-view. Has everyone seen that movie? It's about a young man who is adopted by a family down south, and goes on to be a football star and all these things. Sandra Bullock's in the movie. And there's this one scene where the main character in the movie, Michael, can't get a driver's license because he doesn't have his birth certificate. And, it bothers him because he wants to get a driver's license and do what other teenagers are doing. So Sandra Bullock's character, it's based on a true story, goes into a housing project where she learned that the birth mother lived, and somehow found her, befriended her, got Michael's birth certificate. Next thing you know, he's got his driver's license. So I'm watching this movie, and I just find myself thinking, boy, if Sandra Bullock can do it, maybe I can do it. So the next day, with the help of Kathy Knapp, who's a librarian at the newspaper, we really redoubled our efforts to see if we could find Elizabeth, who is Brent's birth mother. And I won't even get into all the crazy things that we had to do, searching public records and things, but we eventually came across a name that we were pretty certain was her new name, her current name at least. She'd been married and divorced a couple times, so her names had changed. And then, being the great investigative reporter that I am, I Googled the name, and Facebook exists nowadays, which it didn't 10 years ago when Brent first started looking for her to try to answer these questions. And boom, I find her Facebook page. And within an hour, I'm on the phone with her, telling her about the son that she'd given up many, many years ago and his problems. And she was crying and telling me that, you know, she wanted to contact him, and she'd always worried about him. And by the end of the week, Brent had his birth certificate and had a reunion within a couple weeks with Elizabeth, who he now considers a friend. He considers the woman who raised him his mom, but he considers Elizabeth a good friend now. And, you know, they had a touching moment. And so you had this obstacle that was standing in Brent's way, and it was removed. And you know, it was a great story, but it really wasn't that hard. And it kind of breaks your heart to think that, you know, there are kids with these obstacles that just aren't having them pushed out of the way or aren't finding the help that they need. So I think as a community, we need to find a way to make sure that every kid in school that has, you know, one of these obstacles standing in their way, that, you know, we find better ways to get them out of their way so that they can achieve what they're capable of. You know, I always talk about the Mayor's Action Center. Does everyone know what that is? It's the number you call when you want to report a pothole, or you want to there's an abandoned car in your street, or there's a nuisance on your block. You call the Mayor's Action Center, and they take the call, or they take the email, and they farm it out to the right agency, and next thing you know, they take care of your problem. I thought teachers should have the same type of resource that, you know, a teacher has. Spencer, how many students do you have in a day? So Spencer's dealing with 80 students in a day. You know, if he's got 10 that have huge problems, in addition to doing his job, I mean, that's a lot to ask a teacher to deal with those problems. But boy, I wish there were better resources available for teachers when they know a kid's having a problem, that there were, you know, there were more groups, more resources to help them address those problems before they become the crises that they so often become. The third lesson I learned, and again, I knew this, but it was reinforced, and that's that teachers can make an unbelievably huge difference in the education attainment of a student, and how much they learn, how far they go. I can't tell you how many times I met kids who told me, yes, the reason I stuck with school, the reason I pushed myself to get to calculus was because Mrs. Johnston always told me that I could do it, or because Mr. Lloyd pushed me in every classroom, or Mrs. H. told me I was capable of college. I used to joke that I often thought there were twins in the school, a lot of twins in the school, because I'd see a kid in one class, and they'd be perfect, and they'd be studying, they'd show up on time, they'd stay till the end of the classroom, they'd do their homework, they'd pay attention, they'd be engaged. And I would see the same kid in another classroom, and they'd be goofing off or showing up late or leaving early, falling asleep. Well, what was the difference? You know, there was one difference, and that was the teacher at the front of the room. I'm kind of a teacher groupie, or at least a great teacher groupie. I love to watch a great teacher in action. I honestly don't think I could do it for a living. It's an unbelievable talent to be able to teach well. But then beyond that, to be someone who is just so dedicated to the job that you say, nope, every classroom I have to be on top. I have to give my all in every classroom every day. That's most of us. You know, we have jobs that if we're having a bad day, we can kind of slack for a day and, you know, make up for it tomorrow, or we can sleep. You know, we could, you know, write off the morning and decide we're going to work harder in the afternoon and work late. You know, teachers, they have a certain schedule, and they, you know, they have to do it every day, day after day, because they know. I mean, the great teachers that I've met, they tell me, if you let your foot off the gas for a day, you know, a lot of what you've been able to accomplish goes away. So anyone who argues, not to put too much pressure on teachers, but I truly do think that the future of the world depends on them. I mean, anyone who tells you that teachers can't have a huge impact, I just don't think they've sat in classrooms and watched what great teachers accomplish day after day. The fourth thing that I, you know, was really struck by was, you know, we always talk about the achievement gap in education, and it's very real and it exists. But, you know, I think there's also this experience gap that you see in, you know, schools like Manual. I mean, kids just don't have access to the same experiences that kids in districts not far away do. They don't see the broader world as much as a lot of other kids. They don't go to the same places. They don't meet the same people. They aren't exposed to as wide a range of people in different professions. And, you know, I'm a big believer that, you know, kids need to get out of their neighborhood. They need to get out of their city. They need to see what's out there. No matter how nice their world is, it's so important to see other sides of the world and other places. You know, I wrote a lot about Spencer Lloyd's classroom, and people really seemed to take to him and his class, his choir class. And you know, I think part of it was because he was just such a hardworking teacher and, you know, was helping these students achieve their potential. But I think they're also, you know, connected with the students. You know, the students often from kind of very tough circumstances, but we're really giving a lot and really working hard. And I wrote several times about Spencer's choir program, and people really reached out. And, you know, to tie the experience gap and the great teaching together, just a quick story. About 8 months after the series ended in June of 2010, then I went in my merry way and wrote my book and got back to writing about politics, which actually is my job, believe it or not. And, you know, time had passed, and I kept up with Spencer from time to time. And one day, I was sitting in my office, and the phone rang, and it was someone from Carnegie Hall. And they said, "Hey, we see that you've written a lot about the Manual High School Choir. We just want to let you know we've invited them to come play Carnegie Hall in New York City. And, you know, as part of a mass choir program that we're having, you know, we'd like to have the Manual airs there." So I texted Spencer and, you know, wrote, "Carnegie Hall? Question mark?" And he hadn't told me. I was surprised he hadn't told me about it. So we talked on the phone that day, and he said, "Yeah, it's great. We're going to try, but we need to raise, was it $30,000? $35,000 to send the 20 kids and the staff that would have to go to Manual High School. You know, they just don't have that kind of budget at Manual, and a lot of the families can't afford to contribute to trips like that." And so he said, "We're going to do fundraisers. We're going to see what we can do, but I don't know that we can raise the money that we would need to go on this trip." So I said, "Well, you know, readers have really responded, you know, when I've written about the choir, and you know, let's see if they respond again." So the columns I've written about the choir program have been the easiest that I've ever written in my life, because I just go, I sit there for a couple days, I watch a great teacher in action, I watch these really cool students, you know, sing and give their all, and, you know, they tell me their stories, their backgrounds, and I go back and, you know, I'm almost like a stenographer in those cases. I just have to write what I've seen. It's very easy. So I wrote this column, and I said, "Hey, you know, you've reached out to them before. Readers, I just want you to know they've been invited to go play Carnegie Hall, but they need $30,000. They have to have a down payment. I think it was $10,000 within a few weeks or something like that." So I wrote the column hoping that people would at least help a little bit. Well, by the end of the week, how much had you gotten by the end of the week? Yeah, they got $30,000. In the end, what was the total that you received? Yeah, $90,000. So, you know, not only did those kids get to go to Carnegie Hall and spend several days in New York and have that experience that I think every kid should have, you know, that kind of, you know, just seeing a completely different side of the world. Most of these kids had never been on a plane. A lot of them had never been out of the state. A lot of them hadn't been on vacations. Well, you know, now they get to experience this. You know, they got to do what kids in a lot of other districts do. At that choir, there were schools from all over the country, and I was struck. You know, a lot of the kids that I saw from other districts, completely deserving of a trip like this, and hardworking, great kids, absolutely. But it wasn't a big deal for them. They'd been on big trips before. They'd done this kind of thing. Well, I think for the Manual Heirs, it was a pretty big deal. And I think it you know, opened their eyes and got them to see that there's a big world beyond their little slice of it. The last thing I'll mention that I learned, and then if we have any questions, I'm more than happy to talk, and I'm going to invite Spencer up to answer them too, is that the community desperately wants to help the kids and the teachers in these schools. The Carnegie Hall trip was one perfect example of that. But there were several times throughout the year where I would write something about kids, a certain kid, certain teacher, and then the community would respond. They'd come out and they'd help, you know, or they'd write me. Time and again, people wrote me and said, "How can I help Manual High School? What can I do? How can I help this teacher?" I will admit, it was a hard question for me to answer at first. I'm a journalist. I'm paid to, you know, even as a columnist, is allowed to offer opinions and is paid to offer my take. Still, I'm kind of on the sidelines, and you know, I'd been a journalist for a long time. I often say, you know, people don't write me and say, "Hey, how can I help Mitch Daniels?" when I write about politics. But people are writing me saying, "How can I help Spencer? How can I help, you know, this student?" And, you know, what we started doing, we started running a little box in the paper with volunteer organizations or places that you could go to volunteer your time, give money. And these groups would call us and say, boy, people are really responding. And they really want to help. So, you know, we launched the Our Children, Our City series, which really has become what we consider at the paper the most important thing we do, which is, one, to write about the challenges facing our schools and the kids in our city, but also, hopefully, to help engage the community and harness the energy that's out there. There's so many people that want to help. I mean, they desperately want to help. I think often they don't know how to help. Schools sometimes are great about soliciting and welcoming help, sometimes aren't so great. So at the paper, we're really trying to do more to engage the community and help people that want to help and kind of highlight these issues in a greater way. But I think it can't just be the newspaper. It can't just be the local media. It also has to be that the schools have to do everything they can to make sure that if there are people out there that want to help, make sure they can help. I remember one time, last story I'll tell, one of my favorite people in the building at Manual was a woman named Linda Thatcher. And she was the head of a classroom that was for kids with profound learning disabilities. And her goal was to help these kids live as independently a life as they were capable of. If that meant that they could live on their own but have someone have to come check on them a couple times a week, great. Whatever they were capable of, she wanted to get them to that point and make sure that they could live as independently as possible. So, and I loved Linda's classroom. I'd sit in there. The kids were so sweet and interesting. And I wrote a column about Linda. And one thing they had in the classroom was a washer and dryer so the kids could learn how to wash their clothes. Because, you know, it was all about, it really wasn't about I-step or graduation. It was more about teaching these kids to live as independently as possible. So she'd teach them how to do their laundry or go grocery shopping or cook. Well, their washer and dryer were barely hanging on. You know, they're breaking down all the time. And so I put a little box in the paper that said, if you want to help, you know, they need a washer and dryer. So I go in the next week, I think by Tuesday, Wednesday, and Linda finds me and she says, I got 40 offers for washers and dryers. So, you know, I said, take them all, put them on eBay and raise money for the, but those are the kind of things, you know, when people want to help, we got to find ways to maximize that help. These schools, they can't do it on their own. The schools have limited resources. Even if we do, do more to fund these schools, they're still going to have limited resources. So anything we can do to get more people engaged and that kind of thing, I think the better. I think when we talk about things like, you know, school referendum to raise taxes or this debate that I think the state has got to have about early childhood education, and we have to be willing to invest in that. I think the more people that we have engaged in these issues, the better chance that we're going to see success in those kind of things. So you know, that's one reason I think we need to harness this energy. Manual High School changed the way I look at journalism. I walked out of there. I honestly can tell you that has not been a day in the past 20 years that I didn't love being a journalist. It's what I wanted to do from the time I was 4 or 5 years old. I got a paper out when I was 10. Because I love newspapers so more, I'm as energized about the job as I was the day I walked out of college 20 years ago. But I will say nothing has changed the way I look at journalism more than the year I spent at Manual, because of what I learned, and more importantly, because of the way the community responded. And it really showed me that, boy, the kind of journalism I want to do going forward is the kind where I'm helping people understand what's really going on in places like schools when we're having these big public policy debates. And hopefully helping people get more engaged in these important debates that we're having. So thanks so much for showing up and listening. Spencer and I are more than happy to take any questions you might have. So any questions out there? Yeah. As I was writing the story, she asked about the Brent Jones story, which was the young man I referred to as the kid who doesn't exist. When I wrote that column, I decided to do things a little differently, and that was that I didn't tell people how the story ended until the end. I kind of built the story that way. I thought if I told what happened at the very beginning, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense because people didn't know who this young man was. And I heard from so many people. I heard from some people who stopped reading halfway because they said, "I know it's going to end badly, and I don't want to hear it." fortunately, it ended with such a positive story. But as I was reporting it, as I was getting to know Brent, as I was getting to, I mean, he's such a likable young man. You couldn't help but want him to succeed and have every opportunity. So as I was reporting, and I did this over about 3 months. It was the longest piece that I worked on during the year I was there. Wrote plenty of columns in between that, but I started, I think, working on that in January, and it didn't run until April. And so I was really worried that we're going to write about him, and nothing was going to happen, and then he was going to graduate, and you know that was the end of the story. So that was my big concern, and that's why, you know, even as a journalist, I thought, boy, we can't just report this story. We have to get involved a little bit more. That's a good. if you didn't hear it, the question was, how was I received by the teachers? And I'll expand it and say the students. You know, my job isn't to be Mr. Popular as a journalist, and so there were some teachers that really liked me and welcomed me with open arms. Every teacher except for one welcomed me into their classroom, no matter what. Some teachers, though, clearly didn't like me being there. They thought it cast the school in a negative light, and some of the columns did. And as I told people, my job isn't to sugarcoat things. It's to tell the story of what I'm seeing. I was really affected early on in the school year by two young women. I wish I had the time to tell the story. It's in the book. Who walked up to me one day and challenged me to, as they said, write about the kids who are doing the right thing at Manuel. And that really got me thinking that this can't be a series. First of all, I think I would have lost readers early on if it was only gloom and doom for 35 weeks. It couldn't be that. You had to. The title of the book is Searching for Hope. There has to be hope in between, and there's tons of it there. So it's not. It wasn't hard to find. So it had to be a balanced series, or I think people would have got burned out. I think they would have got burned out if it was all positive. You know, I think they wanted the unvarnished truth. But yeah, there were some people who weren't crazy about me being there and let me know. Now, I will say, students were much more inclined to let me know when they didn't like what I wrote. And, you know, I wrote, usually in a series like this, what you'll do is you'll do all your reporting, and then you go back to the office and you write your series, and it runs, and you don't have to go back to where you were. You've done the reporting. This one I did in real time. I did it every week. And I remember after the first column ran, the first column was pretty tough on the school because I'd seen a lot that first couple weeks, and it was pretty tough. And I remember driving up that Monday thinking, well, maybe no one read it. And I walk in, and the librarian, who's been at the school forever, had cut my column out and taped it on the wall right by the front door, so it was the first thing you saw. And she did that every week. And I was fine. It's my job to, you know, if people have a gripe, bring it to me. And I was willing to talk about it. So it was a mixed reaction. I will honestly say it made it much more interesting to know that there are some people that didn't like me and some people did. I kind of liked it. So, yeah. Come on up here. This is Spencer Lloyd, by the way, the choir teacher.
It's interesting because they're still actually giving mixed reactions. Just today, I invited students out here to this event tonight, and I pull Matt's book out of my office, and I said, you know, and one of the students says, I don't like him. One of the teachers told me that he's part of the reason that we're being taken over by the state. And I said, whoa, hold on. She had actually worked for the school newspaper that year. And so she said, I worked, and I read all those articles, and he never said anything nice about us. And I said, no, hold on. She said, well, okay, the choir. And I said, no, you didn't read all these articles then, now, did you? I said, what about Brenton Jones? What about this, that, the other thing? And so anyway, even now, 2 years later, the students are still having mixed reactions about his time there. And
I will say, I mean, it's an unusual thing for a school to have the local paper in the school just about every day of the school year and putting it on the front page. I wrote 34 or 35 columns during the school year. And I think at least 30 of them ran on the front page on Sunday. I mean, that's what we call prime real estate at the paper. That's unusual. I mean, imagine walking into your workplace and having a reporter hanging out in the hallways every day, you know, writing what he or she sees, putting it on the front page. It's a lot. And you know, I should go back sometime. My guess is 60% of the columns were positive. and 40% were hard hitting. But you know, as with everything, when you write a column that's very tough, that one stands out much more. That one stings a little more. So I understand it. But I tell you, you know, I'm from Northwest Indiana. I don't know if you know anything about Northwest Indiana, but you know, I might not look it, but we're pretty tough up there. And we tell you what we think. So I love that kids would walk up to me and say, "You stink." You know, I'm like, "That's fine." You know, that there's nothing wrong with that. And I will tell you, one reason I wrote the book was because, you know, at that point I was able to look back at the entire year, and I saw, you know, by May I thought, boy, a couple things I wrote, some things I wrote early in the school year, I wish I hadn't, because I'd learned a whole. I had a different perspective on what I saw then by the end of the year. It's like everything else in life. You don't learn something one day and then stop learning. You learn something one day, and then over time you gain more experiences. So there were things that I wrote in the book. I have a different take on certain things than I did in the newspaper, because, you know, the newspaper, as I often say, is the first draft of history. The book gave me, I had a lot more experiences to rely on. Yeah, the question is what I would do if I had a magic wand. First thing I would do if I had a magic wand is I would give it to someone a lot smarter and who's much more of an... I tell people all the time, I'm not an education expert. I'm just a journalist. I don't claim to be an education expert. I'm just a journalist who loves writing about education and loves learning about it. But more than anything, I mean, if you took my 20 tips for what we should do to fix schools, number one would be more important than the other 19 combined, and that's early childhood education. I think so many kids arrive at kindergarten already behind. They never catch up. By the time they get to high school, they're so far behind, they never catch up. I don't understand why we get so excited, and I'm all for putting all these resources and all these efforts into high school. I'm all for that. But I don't understand why we don't see the value in it. Attacking issues on the front end as opposed to the back end. I'm sure, any doctors in here? If there were, I'm sure they would tell us that preventive medicine saves a lot of money and a lot of pain as opposed to waiting till the disease or the problem erupts and then addressing it. I think it's the same in education. You know, we just had there was a press conference, I think it was today, about third grade reading scores and this new push to make sure kids are on reading level at third grade, and I'm all for that. That's great. But why do we wait till they're 5 or 6 years old to start reaching toward that goal? Shouldn't we do it when they're three? It's like signing up for a marathon in August but not starting to train until May. That would be ridiculous. You'd start in January and make sure you're ready. I for the life of me, I can't understand why this state doesn't see the value in early learning. I think not only from what it means for the kids, I think there's a cost savings. I think it's pretty well proven that the dollar you invest in early learning pays off down the road. Maybe it doesn't pay off in this election cycle, but it pays off in this generation. So that's by far the number one thing that I would push. And I know you're running for office, so if you're elected, I hope you you pursue that. Sure. I was asked to repeat the question, so just in case anyone didn't hear, it's, you know, people are willing to give so much to a program like Spencer's Choir. What can we do to make sure they want to give resources to the general fund, basically, to pay for schools? Well, first, I think schools have to prove, and districts have to prove that they're spending money efficiently and effectively, and that they're doing everything right. I was in Speedway. I'm working on a piece for a week from Sunday about Speedway, not so much about education, but just about the town of Speedway. And, you know, that's a conservative city, a very Republican city, and very fiscally tight, I guess you would say. But a year and a half ago, they had a referendum on schools, and it passed with 80% to increase taxes. It passed with 86% of the vote. And that's because people are very proud of their schools in Speedway. They all get great ratings. They're considered very efficient and effective and well-run. So I think, for starters, you know, if you're going to ask people to raise their taxes, you have to prove to them that it's being spent wisely. That I think people are willing to spend money on schools. They just don't want it wasted. In IPS district, voters allowed a series of three huge tax increases to improve schools, the capital part of schools, the buildings. I think it totaled $750 million over many years. This happened a while back. So people are willing to do that, I think. You have to convince them that it's being spent in the right way, that it's going to help kids, that the district's being run well. And then on the flip side, unfortunately, you know, these are times when people are very, there's a very strong anti-tax sentiment out there. And I don't think money is the key to education, but we have to make sure whatever the resources that are needed, that's what we have to spend. Get a little nervous by some of the rhetoric about taxes these days. I hope that doesn't lead to a decline in the coming years toward what we do for our schools.
Matt, can I jump in on that? I think that you hit it on the head when you talk about the importance of making sure the money is spent well. Because if you look at a district like IPS, they've got money coming out their ears. But the problem is it's not allocated in the right areas. So, for instance, and I'm not person bashing here, but a school like Manual with enrollment currently that sits somewhere between 500 and 600 students, for us to have five full-time administrators equaling salaries between $400,000 and $500,000, and my curriculum and instruction budget is $700 for the school year, there's a disconnect there. A building that size doesn't need five administrators to do the work for that number of students. But I certainly could use more than $700 to buy music for my students over the course of a school year. And it's not just me. I mean, in the physical education classes and this and that. So I think you hit it on the head with making sure that the funds are allocated properly is where,
that's where it's important.
Yeah. Anyone else? Well, thank you so much one more. Sorry. You know, I haven't spent a lot of time in Warren. Yeah, so I probably need to be careful about, we journalists are more than willing to talk about things we don't understand. But I should probably be careful on something that important. I'll look into it, but at this point I don't have much knowledge of it. So, yeah. That's a great question. The question is, you know, how can schools reach out? All kinds of ways these days. And honestly, the best way is to get the Indianapolis Star out to your, so feel free to call us. I'm always looking for a good story, so I'd love to come out. What school are you at?
Brownsburg.
Who's your principal?
Mark.
Okay. You know, social media makes it a lot easier these days to keep in touch with people. But I think most important, the school just has to really work to build relationships within the community. You know, the series I wrote after the Manual series was about a school called Arlington Woods Elementary. It's on the far east side, a very tough neighborhood, huge problems, but they've had a remarkable turnaround led by the staff there. It's an unbelievable story of success that they've seen. And one thing they've done is they've just worked so hard to build relationships, often with businesses, banks, you know, stores, to provide resources. And one thing they do with those resources, one, they use them to take kids on trips, so they use that to encourage kids to, you know, if you get 99% attendance rate, you go on the trip. But also they've used the money to find ways to get the parents engaged, whether it's by hosting a fair at the school on Saturdays, whether it's giving Christmas presents to all the kids but requiring that the family comes and picks it up so they can, you know, have that interaction with the parents. They've used the money in very smart ways aimed at building those relationships. So, you know, that school is probably the best example that I've seen of a school that's found ways to reach out to people. And that's one, they just literally reach out to businesses and say, hey, can you sponsor us? Can you do this? Can you help us this way? And then they use the resources they get to reach out to their parents and their students and engage people. And then if you have a great story to tell or an interesting story to tell, let us know about it. We're always looking for new schools. One thing, you know, I worry about is that I write so much about IPS. It's a big region, and I don't only want to be a columnist who writes about IPS. I am very interested in the surrounding townships and counties. So feel free to reach out to us. We'll very good chance we'll come out and see what you have to offer. Sure. Thanks so much for coming out, everyone. I really appreciate it.